you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us today. Hope your day's off to a good start. Looks like we may have another beautiful Southern California day. Coming out of the weekend's rain, topsy-turvy weather, but looks like fairly clear sailing ahead. Coming up next hour, we're going to be talking about a parliamentary system. What might that look like in the United States? One of the things I enjoy are these sorts of thought experiments. Parliamentary governmental systems, of course, are not uncommon in other parts of the world. But we're going to be talking with a University of Maryland professor who's written a new book titled Parliamentary America, and I love the subtitle, The Least Radical Means of Radically Repairing Our Broken Democracy. We'll talk with Maxwell L. Stearns about his thesis and what it would be like to have a multi-party system where third parties are not relegated to largely the sidelines, as they so often now in our very strong two-party system in this country. That's coming up next hour here on Air Talk. We'll also be talking about the Los Padrinos Juvenile Hall in Downey, the state board that oversees that facility, which has had numerous complaints about understaffing, unsafe conditions for those working there, as well as for those incarcerated at that facility. We'll be talking about what comes next for Los Padrinos. I also want to invite you to sign up for our Air Talk weekly newsletter, which we just started. It's an opportunity for me to share what's happening behind the scenes on Air Talk, to point towards some of our upcoming segments, as well as some of the ones that I think have just been particularly interesting, where I've learned a lot. And I share a little bit about what I came out of a given segment with, and point you toward it in case you missed it when it was aired live. So please sign up for that. It's free, of course. All you need to do is go to our Air Talk page, laist.com/airtalk. That's laist.com/airtalk. And there you can just sign up, put your email address in, we'll confirm it, and you'll be a subscriber to the weekly newsletter where I write a note at the top, sort of sets things up for what we have in each edition. I also want to invite you to join us for our LAS Dodger Stadium night. It's back, our second annual night at the stadium, Friday, June 21st, and it's a great matchup, the Dodgers and the Angels. So if you're a fan of the Angels more than the Dodgers, we'd still love to have you there. Of course, great rivalry between the two teams. Your contribution is for two Loge tickets to attend the game. You'll be supporting the journalism that you appreciate on LAist 89.3, and you'll be cheering alongside us. It's a great opportunity for me and Nick Roman, of all things considered. Both of us will be there to be able to greet you and posed for so many photos last year. It was really fun. Just a great time for Nick and me to meet so many of our listeners. We hope that you can join us. Donate now at laist.com/Dodgers. That's laist.com/Dodgers to pick up your pair of Loge level tickets Friday evening, June 21st. The Dodgers hosting the Angels. It's LAist night at Dodger Stadium, the second annual event. We are waiting right now for NPR's David Folkenflik, the media correspondent for NPR, as we have breaking news that Uri Berliner, who is senior business editor at NPR, just announced his resignation. He posted on X to Catherine Marr, who's the new CEO of NPR, "I am resigning from NPR, a great American institution where I've worked for 25 years. I don't support calls to defund NPR. I respect the integrity of my colleagues and wish for NPR to thrive and do important journalism. But I cannot work in a newsroom where I am disparaged by a new CEO whose divisive views confirm the very problems at NPR I cite in my Free Press essay." In case you've not been following this story, Uri Berliner last week wrote an essay published on the website Free Press, in which he was highly critical of NPR's lack of viewpoint diversity, the editorial process for how stories were framed and debated, and also looked at the leadership of the network and was critical of the general direction of NPR, which he said he thought, to paraphrase, that it was more sort of, telling listeners what to think than instead, of being an open-minded journalistic organization. Obviously, every NPR listener is going to have an opinion about whether you think Yuri Berliner was right or not about his assessment of the network, but the repercussions have been significant, including calls to defund NPR from a couple of members of Congress, Berliner mentioning that he does not support defunding calls in his posting on X, and then, of course, his resignation with repercussions as well. With us, David Folkenflik, NPR media correspondent. David, thank you for joining us. I know you're busy hitting deadline with the story about Yuri's resignation. You talked with him recently. Are you surprised that he stepped down today?
At this point, it almost seems like it's the inevitable consequence of the events that have played out in recent days. They involve, Uri posting on the Free Press, as you just mentioned, to listeners. It involves him speaking also to the New York Times. In both instances, the essay he posted, the podcast he appeared on the Free Press, and then last Thursday on the New York Times, although that wasn't cited by NPR, those were done in violation of his contract, and in fact, just the employee code of conduct to not speak to outside media organizations without approval of the network. As you know, I do that a lot. Other colleagues do that a lot, but you do it with approval. You do it with authorization. You can even do it, particularly in my case, because I cover NPR and the press, you can do it when being critical of NPR or at least descriptive of NPR. They don't meddle with what I have to say, but they don't want to be surprised and they want to have some discretion as to whether or not that happens. This was Uri, let me offer a series of disclosures. I'm not speaking for NPR, although they pay my checks. I'm speaking as a reporter covering this story and with some insight on it. Uri was one of my editors. He's not, he's part of the union. He's not a manager or supervisor, but he's on my desk, the business desk. He's involved in a lot of my coverage, including coverage of some of the stories, or at least my stories dealing with the matters that he was most critical about. He cited, just so your listeners know, NPR's coverage of COVID-19, of the Trump years, of trans rights and sort of the emergence of that movement, and others that are, the Hunter Biden laptop, and certain others as sort of intrinsic examples of how NPR is sort of viewing things through what he believes to be a progressive mindset. He wasn't fired for this critique, which was pretty strong, but he was, rebuked for violating the code of conduct by appearing outside this. Then, there was a lot of anger, frustration, dismay, distrust, as well as among some colleagues, some appreciation for at least parts of his critique. But there's a particular, backlash to the fact that he coupled that with a critique of the previous chief executive John Lansing's focus, or North Star, as he put it, on the question of increasing the diversity of our workforce as both a moral imperative and as a business strategy so that we could attract a younger, more diverse audience and a greater overall audience that would look more like America. Berliner presented some demographic data, some of which NPR also punished him for sharing because it was proprietary, that suggested the gains in that realm had been very modest indeed, and that in the process we were, losing a lot of a significant number of listeners, to which he at least attributed part of that to the idea that we were no longer sounding like all of America, but pursuing a more specific audience. I think a lot of my colleagues took that to suggest that as we've hired a lot more people of color, that somehow their presence wasn't for journalistic reasons or for merit, but simply part of, DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion matters, as opposed to journalistic. Berliner takes real exception at that, but Catherine Marr, chief executive, sort of echoed some of that critique of what Berliner had to say. And he was he felt that he was being disparaged by her, and also that some of her social media postings, we can talk about this in a moment, of her past political beliefs had discredited her from being able to leave the network.
She had posted, I believe, and this goes back well before her tenure, because she's only been with NPR for a month, I think, that Donald Trump is a racist. Things in that vein, David?
Yes, she had posted that Donald Trump was a racist. She had at times posted things during some of the social justice movements of the late spring of 2020. The idea that violence or property damage during riots were, you know, it seemed to somehow minimize or in some ways excuse the severity of that in the light of, all the historic systemic and current injustices that people of color, particularly African Americans at that moment, were protesting against, and that if some of those protests turned violent, it was in some ways understandable. And she had done so for some years. I mean, some past posts going back to 2014, what have you. You know, she is 40 years old. So if you're stretching back to 2014, you're stretching back to when she was not in media, not a chief executive, and about 30. Take that for what it's worth. It's at a different point in her life. Berliner doesn't say that. Says that he's not saying that that's disqualifying that she did that necessarily, but that it shows that she's not the right person to lead the network at a time where our commitment to diversity of viewpoint has been called into question, not just by him, but in the days since his essay by a lot of conservatives online, a lot of partisan Republicans online, but also a certain degree of other people, including journalists, who have raise that question as well.
We're talking with NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, in case you just joined us. Uri Berliner, who's senior business editor at NPR, announced his resignation just about an hour ago, posting on X, and particularly citing the new CEO of NPR, saying that he was disparaged by the new CEO. And we're talking with David about how this has been received within the organization. One of the points that Uri made, David, I've been in public radio for more than 40 years. This has been an ongoing challenge. How do we attract journalists with viewpoint diversity? Most of us come from liberal families. Most of us come from a particular, sector of the population that isn't representative of the population at large. NPR has been heavily white and heavily coming from a particular class throughout the course of its history. It's had gender diversity, but has struggled with diversity in other areas, including political background diversity. And so his point is that NPR hasn't really focused on that. And I think it's a tremendous challenge in public media generally to do that. And this it's become more center stage because we've become more polarized as a country. And so when you don't have as much crossover, seemingly the moderate segment of America seems to have declined. I think that, one of the things Uri is pointing out, this kind of puts it in stark relief where you've got people that are choosing sides, and it puts a particular burden on NPR, all of it, and local stations, to try and represent the range of views when they are more polarized. I'm curious your thoughts about, David, how you think Uri was trying to characterize that challenge.
Well, look, I would say that it's hard to take issue with anything that you just laid out for our listeners. I think that NPR sees itself with justification as a broadcaster, meaning it is trying to reach a broad audience of the communities it serves, its stations serve. And to, part of the magic of public radio is when we do it right, people hear themselves, their points of view, but also their voices, either their own voices or those of people that they feel some kinship to, reflected on the air. And it doesn't mean that everybody is reflected equally perfectly. And it doesn't mean that everybody's a point of view is given perfectly equal, standing in front of the facts. But we're going to treat people with respect, particularly people's views, because most of the time that's their sensibility. It's where they come from. It's, you know, who they are at the moment, rather than, you know, them saying, you know, night is day or black is white. Although we've gotten more into that world, I think, in the past, call it 8-9 years, than we had been before. And part of that is social media. Part of that's the asymmetrical political climate we live in. Part of that is the breakdown of conventional press, you know, all the things that that you and I talk about a fair amount, Larry. I would say that Uri's point, look, simply from a strategic standpoint, if Uri is trying to do this, he probably would have been heard better by his colleagues if he had not linked it as closely to the question of diversity, equity, and inclusion, the North Star hiring practices, which have increased NPR's diversity for sure in the past 5 years, I would argue. At least from my reading of the numbers. You know, even as there's some times at which, you know, significant hosts of color and other journalists have left the network to work other places, they have other opportunities to do that as well. And they're not, you know, captive by the idea that NPR is the only place you can work in audio. There's a million places doing podcasts and audio right now. But I do think that, you know, there is an argument to be made, and that some of my colleagues, veterans, including people of color, some of them younger as well, believe there's an argument to be made to say, hey, listen, we've done some work to remedy ways in which some voices really weren't being heard. Often people of color, often people of different economic backgrounds, often people away from the coastal elites. And sometimes we've done better at doing a job of making sure those voices are heard. But sometimes that comes at a you know, to say that you're remedying something and suggest that you perfectly recalibrate to within a percentage point of where you perfectly should align is not consistent with the human experience in any institution, right? If you're recalibrating, you may have to adjust. And so if he had been making an argument purely of, I don't think that we are listening closely enough to dissonant voices that may end up having a point. He talked about the COVID-19 coverage and, you know, NPR and other major news organizations really were quite dismissive of the possibility that there was a lab leak issue in Wuhan, as opposed to getting free at the market of these, exotic animals, and that it escaped that way. And it now appears that that is something that credible researchers and scientists feel at least have to be significantly addressed. In fact, President Biden is on the record having essentially ordered federal institutes to look into that in a way that in the first years were very much dismissed. And NPR and other major news organizations were highly dismissive of that prospect. Now, part of that is because it was initially being touted by people like, you know, former President Trump, former Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, both of whom had said things that proved to be untrue in Trump's case repeatedly in ways that didn't lend credence to that notion. And this is not, the lab leak thing is not proven, and it's not even clear that it's a plurality of people who are researchers in the area believe in it. But, you know, people need to acknowledge that. One thing I will say is that I did a significant segment on that very question. I critiqued the mainstream press's earlier approach, and I acknowledged NPR had fallen short in certain ways too. NPR did do coverage to revisit that. And in fact, Uri, as one of my editors, has been involved in such segments over the years, in part because I wanted his voice as part of those discussions. So the idea that some are taking from Berliner's essay, perhaps not one he intended, but that those voices aren't present in conversations that yield the coverage that you hear on NPR, I think is unfair to a lot of the sort of intense conversations that get there, even as I think it's fair for our coverage to be subject to scrutiny, whether on the Israel-Hamas war or COVID or Trump or you know, question of free trade or other things.
We're talking with NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik about the resignation of NPR senior business editor Uri Berliner, who posted on X his resignation. This followed a 5-day suspension he received for publishing an essay critical of NPR without the permission of the network. And I just want to disclose, we have the same policy here at LAist. Whenever I do an outside event, I run that by my superiors here, and often it's because I want input. I want feedback before I agree to do something that it's in keeping with the journalistic standards of the organization. There are things I'll just say no to because without even running it by my bosses, because I don't feel it's appropriate for me to be involved with, but other things I may want to consult with them, and other things I just pro forma, I run it by it because they have a right to say, no, we don't think that that is appropriate, because as an employee, I am de facto representing the organization. So there, this is common in media to require that kind of approval. Then there is the separate issue that we're talking about, David and I are talking about, how this is being perceived, what about the critique that Uri made, and how are listeners perceiving of what we do in public media? David, you mentioned that this, has created, roiled things at NPR. Are there people who have stood behind Uri's critique and are glad that he's written what he wrote?
I've talked to people, including journalists, who look, and I just want to say, without getting into details, what Uri wrote didn't surprise me in terms of the critique of NPR, because his voice has been one that I've listened to. He's been a colleague and something of a friend I consider him a friend for almost 20 years. I'm a little shy of my 20th anniversary there. So, it doesn't come as a radical surprise. That was part of the discussions that occurred within NPR. I would say that there are colleagues who are appreciative of the questions he raised, the way in which he did it by coupling, and he says this wasn't his intent, and that in fact he supports NPR's efforts to diversify its workforce. He thinks that's important, at least what he said to me. And if you look at his essay, he does not explicitly say this was wrong, but he ties the effort to seek diversity to what he feels is a lack of viewpoint diversity in a way that a number of our colleagues took it that way. I must say a number of other colleagues said they no longer wanted to work with him, reporters and even certain hosts, because they felt, or at minimum, they felt that they didn't want to email anything because they were worried it could be used in subsequent outside commentary, that he wouldn't trust that. Now, Uri says, if you look at his piece, there's no specific back and forth that he's revealing. It's more sort of the amalgamation and an accretion of impressions and experiences that he's had at the network. But I can tell you, it's an ironic thing, because all of us as journalists are seeking to get inside information and real time, sort of impressions and back and forths and how people's mind works. What happens behind the closed doors? How do you pierce the veil? This is a reporter's warp and woof, right, Larry? So, do you look to do that for Meta, Facebook? Do you look to do that for the Justice Department? Do you look to do that for, the New York Times in my beat if I cover media? Do you look to do that for NPR? These are all things that reporters you want, but as an institution, it turns out it's incredibly disruptive when a broadside is launched that deeply. That's different from, a very specific episode. It's saying, I am questioning he says he's not questioning the integrity of his colleagues. And in fact, he said that explicitly in a note he sent to the newsroom about indicating how long he's had these concerns and been trying to raise them with news editors, since basically the day that Trump was elected. And he said that he had never questioned the integrity of his colleagues, but certainly the integrity of the news report is being questioned because people are looking at it through blinders. He's just saying people aren't intending to do this. He's arguing that there's been kind of an ideological bubble. I've talked to a number of people who feel that he has a strong point that, and I can tell you as somebody who not only covers the media, but who critiques it as well. I will say that if you take the accretion of events, the rise of sort of the Trump Republican Party, the sort of increased siloing of that social media encourages or fosters, the Me Too movement that really started 2016, 2017 with all the sexual harassment scandals that taught us that women and particularly younger colleagues needed to be listened to, you know, when they raised concerns. And then the social justice movement of 2020, sparked by the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, combined with the isolation we all experienced and that was fostered by the pandemic, has meant that newsrooms have been seeking to make up for a lot of decades of, some people would call them wrongs, systemic marginalization of people who didn't have the power. But, you know, there it's concomitantly, I think, been hard for news leaders. And you see the New York Times wrestling with this from its publisher, A.G. Sulzberger, to its editor, Joe Kahn, not just in trying to get a handle on how people express themselves on social media, sometimes in ways that give ammunition to the newsroom's critics, but also in ways to say we need to find ways to reflect how people think and in a textured way and a nuanced way beyond our own neighborhoods, outlooks, and sensibilities.
We're talking with NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. This is a much bigger conversation than we have time for today. I do just want to go back, though, to the diversity issue and Uri's critique of that. Critics of diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, you know, one of the points that they make is that they're not anti-diversity, but there's a particular point of view that goes with DEI efforts that sort of determines what's acceptable and not acceptable and how to frame issues that revolve around race, and it kind of limits open discussion about issues related to race, how we think about the topic. So I think, you know, it is important to differentiate. For some people, they don't see diversity efforts and DEI is necessarily the same thing. And I don't know whether that's Uri's view, but that is a part of the public discussion.
Yeah, and I don't want to get too tripped up because there are certain things at NPR that probably would fall under the rubric of DEI and certain things that wouldn't, that still are part of what our former chief executive John Lansing called the North Star, the idea that you're trying to reach a younger audience, which is definitionally going to be a more diverse audience. We want to have that reflected within our newsroom so that we sort of understand it, so that people hear those voices, so those experiences are reflected. You know, there is, you know, if you do the math, you can argue that diversity of ethnicity and race, you know, and orientation doesn't necessarily mean outlook diversity. That is, that those can be have some ideological conformity theoretically, but you know, a lot of my colleagues have said with some heat and with some reason, hey, just because you've got a bunch of Latinos or African Americans doesn't mean they all experience life the same way, doesn't mean they all live the same way, doesn't mean they all think the same way. And to say so or suggest so is slighting, demeaning, and offensive, which is part of what I think Catherine Morrow was trying to articulate on their behalf as chief executive. But it's a... it's adjacent to the primary thrust of what I think impelled Berliner to speak his mind publicly, for good or for ill. But it has greatly complicated, I think, the ability of the newsroom to absorb that in on its own. And so, you know, that's the human element of what we're talking about right now. Even as some colleagues, as I've mentioned, certainly have told me that they think that part of Uri's thrust, the question of not hearing enough of what other parts of the nation or other sensibilities perceive to be the case, is a real challenge for NPR and something we have to think about. I might add that, you know, our chief executive last week, chief news executive last week, Edith Chapin, announced what will be these monthly coverage review sessions led by the deputy editor in chief, the executive editor of the network, Eva Rodriguez, who's going to basically lead colleagues in parsing out whether our coverage has, you know, covered the full scope and texture of American life and American viewpoints, not simply in terms of diversity of heritage, that's a big part of it, but also diversity of outlook and geography and all the rest. And, you know, it's something that's been talked about for a long time, as Chapin acknowledged to me, but it's something that it seems to me fair to say has been uncorked by Berliner's essay, and that even he says may end up being a good thing, but it depends on how it plays out.
I'm going to just read a couple listener comments. David Falkenflik, NPR media correspondent with us. Adam in Los Angeles emailed, I absolutely agree with Berliner's assessment of NPR. There was a time when NPR was centered. That time has passed. NPR is now a leftist news organization. One of the things I most appreciate most about your program is remain centered. You as the host never push your personal opinions. Anna from Ohio, I'm currently listening to Larry's segment about Uri Berliner's resignation. I'm one of the listeners Uri described in his article, which I just Googled, white, drive a Tesla, liberal. I'm also aligned with him in one other way. I feel that NPR has stopped giving me unbiased news in favor of biased advocacy. That's why I've stopped listening much, why I've stopped any and all donations, which I now direct elsewhere. It feels like a breakup with my lover of decades. And we have John in Fullerton who emailed, AirTalk's a great example of how to present alternative viewpoints. I admit sometimes what a guest says makes my blood boil, but they shouldn't be silenced. However, they should be fact-checked and counterpointed. As far as NPR, GOP senators and representatives have accused NPR of progressive bias from its inception, but I hear them on the air all the time. Seems like they never miss a hit. And Robert in Sherman Oaks said, I just like to say I'm a longtime NPR listener. To me, the problem isn't a lack of political diversity. The problem is really the lack of ethnic diversity. Good that you have a lot of women, but there should be more people of color. That's Robert in Sherman Oaks. Thank you so much, David, for spending all this time with us. I know you've got an extremely busy day. Always appreciate you speaking with our listeners here on Air Talk.
Thanks, Larry. You bet.
Thank you. David Falkenflik, NPR media correspondent, joining us. Coming up, we're going to be talking about Los Angeles County and an apartment inspection and enforcement overhaul that's taking place for the county. We'll hear from stakeholders and what the effect of it might be when we come back in 90 seconds. It's Air Talk on LA 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. The LA County Board of Supervisors has unanimously voted to increase apartment inspections and to withhold rent payments from negligent landlords. Joining us to talk about what led to this action by the board and what it means for tenants and property owners is our LAist housing reporter, David Wagner. David, good morning.
Hey, good to be here, Larry.
So what is the Board of Supes responding to with this?
So this has been in the works for years. You know, tenant activists have pushed for an overhaul of county apartment inspections and code enforcement going back to really before the pandemic. And the supervisors even put this motion forward 2 years ago now. So this has been a long time in the works. And it's really just in response to tenant complaints that they're, you know, living in unhealthy, unsafe housing, that repairs are not getting made, that landlords are not responding to these issues. And that when they complain to the county about it, and get inspectors to come out, you know, violations can be written up, citations can be given to landlords, but still just changes don't get made. So this is a really big change to how inspections are going to work and how code enforcement will take place in unincorporated LA County.
And we should just, so it's unincorporated. This doesn't apply to any of the cities in LA County who have, they have their own housing inspection?
That's right. And these programs here that are being set up for the unincorporated areas of the county, they're really modeled to a large degree on programs in the city of LA that has been doing these kinds of inspections and this kind of, you know, withholding rent from negligent landlords since 1998. So there is a precedent for this kind of approach to inspections and enforcement. But you're right, this is only going to apply to those unincorporated areas. East LA, City Terrace, parts of South LA.
Marina Del Rey, Altadena.
Yeah, about a million people live in these areas. So it's a big deal for a lot of tenants and a lot of landlords.
Parts of Southeast Los Angeles. And with doing this every 4 years, does the county have the personnel to do that many inspections?
Well, they're going to have to staff up. The public health department estimates it's going to take 15 full-time employees to get this inspection program up and running. They're going to have to hire those people, train them. So inspections are set to start 6 months from now. So they've got some time, but not a whole lot of time before they need to get ready to carry out these inspections.
We're talking with David Wagner, LAist housing reporter. How's it going to work, David, with withholding payments? I mean, do we know what the protocol, how the tenant deals with this, or how the inspector sets the process in motion to withhold rent?
Yeah, so, you know, this all starts with just inspectors going out to every unit. They look around for things like, you know, code violations like busted windows, holes in walls, pests, rodents, missing, you know, light fixtures, electricity, hot water, anything that would make the place unhealthy, unsafe to live in. And then landlords get some time to fix these problems. If they do, you know, they get cleared for that. If they make some progress, they could get extensions to make those repairs. But if they, over time refuse to make those repairs, then the property could be put in this rent escrow account program, or REAP. And what that basically means is that the county will reduce rents for the tenants living there first, and then it will hold the rent payments from those tenants in an escrow account, and the landlord will not be able to touch that money until they make repairs. And then once the county is satisfied that the repairs are made, then the landlord gets all these rent payments back. So that's supposed to motivate landlords to get out there to these properties and make these repairs.
David Wagner, LAist housing reporter, is with us. Also joining us, the director of organizing and advocacy at Strategic Actions for a Just Economy. The acronym is pronounced SAGE. It's a tenant advocacy group. Oscar Zarate, thank you very much for being with us. What are your hopes for this new, more frequent series of county inspections?
Good morning, Larry. It's good to be with you. I'm hoping for more accountability. I think that's what our members at SAGE have been asking for years. It's difficult. It's tough to be living in conditions that are deplorable and that don't allow children and their families to live normal lives, right? Yesterday at public comment, we heard from a lot of mothers, right? Erika, Ludres, who children can't have ice cream because they have no electricity and the refrigerator isn't working, who can't take hot showers. So I think for many tenants, they're looking for recourse, accountability, and someone to just have their back when they're facing some of the most challenging things in their lives.
Oscar, what about Los Angeles? You know, David was mentioning it's kind of modeled on what LA is doing. What's your sense of the success of that city's program?
I think there are successes and challenges with any government program, right? Like, it's bureaucracy is bureaucracy. I think in the city of LA, the SCEP program is effective. Obviously, there's room for improvement as well with REAP. There are some properties in the city of LA's REAP program that have kind of languished in the program. We're hoping to not make the same mistakes with the county's REAP program. And we've gave the county a set of recommendations to hopefully approve it administratively. And make sure that repairs are done more quickly and there's more transparency, at least for the tenant.
We're talking with Oscar Zarate, Director of Organizing and Advocacy at SAGE, a tenant advocacy group. He's mentioning REAP, which stands for Rental Housing Habitability Program. That is this beefed up inspection process, minimum once every 4 years. David, do we know what was the previous standard? Did it have a time frame on it?
So in the previous way that the county responded to these issues, they would respond to tenant complaints. So a tenant would complain saying, I'm dealing with these issues. Public health inspectors would come out and write up any violations they saw. But all apartments were not routinely inspected. And in fact, in some buildings, inspectors could come out, look at 10% of the units, and that would satisfy the rules that the county had laid out. This is a big change where every single unit is supposed to be inspected once every 4 years. This is how it works in the city of LA. Inspectors come, check things out, write up reports.
How did they get access to all the units, though?
So they give the landlord notice. Then the landlord has to give the tenant notice. Some, advance warning, hey, you know, a county worker is going to be coming to check out the place. So tenants know ahead of time that these inspections are going to happen. But yeah, inspectors come into your unit, look around, notice anything, write it up, tell the landlord, and then fixes are supposed to be made.
Wow, that is a huge process, every unit. Fred Sutton, Senior VP of Public Affairs for the California Apartment Association, with us. Fred, thank you for joining us again. What position does your association take on the county supervisors putting this in motion?
We all want safe and habitable housing. No one is here to protect the things that Oscar is describing. And what he just described here is already illegal. But I think that the thing that we've been trying to relay for since this was initially passed, the concept, is why are we doing 100% of units? We should use our resources, finances, and time to address the properties that Oscar has described here. Why are we spending 1 minute on a property that has no history of compliance issues and is run in excellence? The resources should really be focused on these bad actors.
We'll continue our conversation with stakeholders and with our own LAist housing reporter, David Wagner. We have a listener, Steve, in Long Beach, who is a landlord, small landlord, for nearly four decades. We'll get his take on this. We're at 866-893-5722. Back in a minute.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle with LAist housing reporter David Wagner, who's talking about the reporting he's been doing, which you can read in depth at LAist.com about the LA County Board of Supervisors unanimously voting to increase apartment inspections to a minimum of every 4 years for every rental unit in unincorporated Los Angeles County. It also allows for the withholding of rent payments that go into an improvement account, essentially, to be used for repairs to make the units habitable for those that are renting there before the landlord would be able to receive those rent payments. Julie in Santa Barbara says, I own three properties in North Hollywood. I've been inspected by the city for 20 years. I think they're excellent. I think the only people who'd be against this are the bad actors. Steve in Long Beach, I understand you have been a landlord for nearly four decades. What do you think of LA County making this move?
Well, thank you, Larry, for covering this important issue. As someone who has known many, many tenants, I think this is a good and important move. Over the years, I've heard from many tenants about terrible conditions in their previous apartments, but most of them, quite honestly, most of those who've lived in the worst conditions have been afraid of reprisals if they complained. Tenants deserve respect. For my family, and we've basically owned 2 to 4 unit properties where either my wife and I or our kids live in one of the units, the tenants have paid my mortgage over the years with their rents and thus paid for housing. I would add that here in Long Beach, we already have this kind of program of proactive enforcement. And I think it does exactly what the county is planning, which is it catches health endangering violations that the tenants were afraid to report. So I hope that the county hires enough inspectors, because this is a big job,
yeah,
to do the job. This is a problem in Long Beach. The program doesn't move as fast as it should.
My final comment is
I'm really tired of the whining complaints from the landlord lobbies. And in fact, I dropped my membership in one of those groups, despite the fact that it provides some good services, because I don't want one penny of my dues to be used to lobby against tenants.
Steve, I appreciate your call. Thank you very much. And Amy in West Adams says, I think by doing the random inspections, it levels the playing field. It's not just the tenants doing the reporting. It's a good use of resources. That's Amy in LA's West Adams district. David, you've done the math on what the cost of this is. And I was trying to think, well, gosh, how many units in unincorporated LA County every 4 years, you know, what that would be, and then how many people it would take to do the inspections.
Right. So there are an estimated 119,000 units of rental housing in unincorporated parts of LA County. It's a lot of units.
Yeah.
This would not apply, these routine inspections would not apply to single family homes that are being rented out, mobile homes. So, you know, there are some exceptions, but 119,000 units, all apartments in unincorporated LA County being inspected. And the way this would be paid for is by fees. So fees to landlords would cover the cost of this. It's $86 per year per unit. And landlords could pass half of that cost off to their tenants. So, you know, $86 per unit per year, that's what's going to cover the funding, the funding needed to carry out this program. It's going to raise monthly costs a little bit for landlords and potentially for some tenants too.
So we're looking at probably 25 to 30,000 units a year that have to be inspected, just doing the math. That's a lot of units. And I don't know how long these take. Do you have a sense of how long it takes for them to do an individual unit?
I think that really depends. I think they can be a few minutes if everything looks good.
Yeah.
I think they can take a lot longer if inspectors are coming out and discovering a lot of problems. So I think that just really depends.
A point that was raised by Fred Sutton of the California Apartment Association is why put all the resources into property that haven't been a problem, that are well-maintained. You've got well-to-do renters who, you know, have some degree of clout with complaining about things. Why inspect those as well? Oscar, you have a thought on why every unit should be inspected?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of what the previous caller, Steve, talked about. It's about leveling the playing field. What I really like about this program is its proactive nature, right? There are tenants that are scared of reprisal and being retaliated against for making complaints. And I think a uniform proactive inspection program really uplifts those complaints that maybe get underreported.
All right. Fred Sutton, elaborate, please, on your concern about, because I could see where it's not necessarily obvious that units have been neglected from the outside. Sometimes you might see, oh, yeah, the maintenance on the outside of the building indicates maybe the inside's not so great. But I have to assume there are places where there are problems inside that you wouldn't necessarily know that from looking at the exterior.
Yeah. One, retaliation is illegal. That's already illegal. And it's really not about why, it's what's the best policy here. Again, this concept was approved 2 years ago, and what that program is going to look like. Is it going to look like the city of Los Angeles, which is, up until this program, is the only city in the nation to do 100% of units? And they did a study a few years ago on that program, about 95% of the properties are well kept. So there are different ways that this inspection program could go. Down in Long Beach, they do not do 100% of the units. They sample units and reserve the right to go into 100% of the units. Again, I think this will come back to fundamentally what's leveling the playing field of spending time on a property that has no history of bad compliance. After an inspection, a baseline inspection, it comes back with an excellent record. Why are we going to continue to focus on those properties when we need to address the issues that both the caller has? And Oscar has.
So let me just clarify
your expansion of the bureaucracy there.
So Fred, let me just clarify. You're saying if rental property comes back, everything looks good, you've got the same ownership, they've proven at an earlier point in time that they're responsible landlords, that then they don't need to be reinspected 4 years later. Is that what you're saying?
Or a different type of tier and a different cost structure. And that's actually what the county did yesterday. They introduced a motion to review something like a Gold Star program. Why would we spend the same exact amount of money per unit for a property that's in good compliance? Why would you inspect them on the exact same cycle in a property that's good compliance when they should focus on problematic properties? And just something about the cost. On a 50-unit building, this is $86 per unit per year. you're talking about $20,000 for one inspection. I mean, we'll send those resources where they're needed. That's the problem, properties.
Okay, you said 50 units. How much is it, did you say?
50 units at $86 a year is roughly close to $20,000. I think it's $17,000 for one inspection that both tenants and landlords are going to be paying.
All right. David, just closing thought on this. We're almost out of time, but I know you'll have continuing coverage on the effects of this.
Yeah, I mean, I've been out to tenants' homes in person to see some of these issues, and there's a real sense from a lot of tenants that because of LA's expensive housing market, they have no choice but to put up with these living conditions. You know, they're dealing with pests, mold, you know, lack of hot water, electricity for years in some cases. And sometimes I ask them, why don't you just move? And they say, there's nowhere else I can afford
to go. David, thank you so much. LAist housing reporter David Wagner. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Much more to come in the second hour. I'll tell you about it in a moment.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So glad to have you with us today. Coming up later this hour, a thought experiment with University of Maryland law professor Maxwell L. Stearns. His book, Parliamentary America, The Least Radical Means of Radically Repairing Our Broken Democracy. I'm looking forward to our conversation with him. But we lead off with the future of Los Padrinos Juvenile Hall, the facility in Downey that has been embattled and so many concerned about the incarcerated youths there, about probation officers there, and the understaffing at that juvenile hall. Joining us, Robert Garova, LAist mental health reporter, has been closely following the saga at Los Padrinos. Robert, good to have you with us again. We appreciate it. So for those who have not been closely following this story, what's the backstory to this state board making this determination?
Yeah, so last week they made essentially a determination to leave Los Padrinos open. The backstory to that was, probation department was coming up on a 60-day deadline that they had to move about 300, youths out of Los Padrinos because they had previously found them what's called unsuitable to continue holding youths there. Narrowly in the nick of time, some would say, the probation department showed that they had met bare minimum staffing levels, done some improvements as far as use of force training, safety checks, and things like that. So the state board said that they could continue holding those kids there.
What were some of the use of force complaints about what personnel there had done with the incarcerated youths?
Well, it's interesting to point out that last week, I think it was the same day that we got the vote from the state board to allow Los Padrinos to stay open. LA Times, got a hold of some video that shows a number of probation employees seemingly standing by as a 17-year-old there was beat up on by some other youths in the facility. So that's a big one. That's sort of, still being pending. There's some lawsuits there. There are some other issues as well, but I think that's the biggest one that's in everyone's mind right now. And it wasn't at Los Padrinos, but a year ago, 18-year-old Brian Diaz died of apparent drug overdose at a facility in Sylmar. If you want to go back to the saga back then, I mean, that, there was folks, kids were moved out of that facility going back a year or so now. So a lot of back and forth, kids moving around, and now still problems at this facility here in Downey.
We're talking about Los Padrinos Juvenile Hall there. Also with us, Jonathan Bird, who's second VP and chief steward for the LA County Deputy Probation Officers Union. Jonathan, thank you for being with us. Your thoughts about the state allowing Los Padrinos to stay open?
Well, thank you, Larry, for the invitation, first of all. And on behalf of the probation officers, the rank and file, we simply like to say that we appreciate the BSCC understanding the situation that has occurred from years of neglect in terms of hiring. And therefore, it has led to a critical staffing shortage. Our field operations and field officers have dedicated themselves to come and assist until LA County get the staffing numbers up so that we can run the programs in the proper manner. So we know that we are capable of doing the job. We've been doing the job for many years. We've been successful, but through some of the systematic operations from high as the Board of Supervisors, it has caused us to not have the workforce that is needed to make sure that things are run properly. That seems to be turning around. Seems that we are starting to get things in place. And as we proceed further with the oversight of the BSCC, we're sure that we'll be able to manage these operations that will be necessary to keep the youth safe and the employees safe, and also be able to habilitate them to a level that they can return to the community in a more effective manner.
We're talking with Jonathan Bird, a leader of the LA County Deputy Probation Officers Union. Robert Garova, so he's mentioning the continuing oversight of this Board of State and Community Corrections, the BSCC. Do they have other conditions that are being applied to Los Padrinos going forward, corrective actions that they need to take?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that was still left sort of pending was that there had been improvement on getting folks up to date on use of force training, but that, you know, remained to be seen. You know, I should mention that the board was very cautious, and there was a lot of back and forth in their vote to allow it to stay open. It was 6 yeses to 3 noes. You know, there was the caveat that they were going to continue to have ongoing, unannounced, I think monthly inspections of Los Padrinos. So, you know, I think the chair pointed out, you know, that this was not come too lightly, and that there were still issues that were going to need to be worked out.
All right. We're talking with Robert Garova, LAist mental health reporter. Also with us is Melinda Kakani, Youth Justice Director for the Children's Defense Fund, California. She's also a commissioner for the LA County Probation Oversight Commission. Millie, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So what are your ongoing concerns about the operations at Los Padrinos?
I mean, probably too many to list, but I want to start by saying that this didn't start in August of last year when Los Padrinos first reopened, right? In 2021, our juvenile halls were out of compliance with these minimum standards set forth by the BSCC for 321 days. In 2022, it was 206 days. In 2023, 353 days, right? And minimum standards aren't just, did you sign in? Did you sign out? Did you complete this log? Right, these standards cover how often rooms are checked, how often grievance processes are double checked, whether they're adequate, how we treat young people after we spray them with chemical agents, which California still allows and LA continues to do, right? So the failure to meet minimum standards has meant that young people are urinating in empty milk cartons in the corners of their cells, right? It means that days can go by where young people don't get to leave their carceral facilities, not just like, obviously not leave outside of the barbed wire, but not even leave like their day rooms and their cells. So the consequences that we're dealing with are far more, again, than just checklists. And I know that Mr. Bird talks about it being just a staffing issue, but it is far more than a staffing issue. It's a cultural issue, right? When in that video released by the LA Times, when a dozen kids are beating up one young person while staff, and this is a fully staffed unit, right? There's like 5 or 6 staff standing around. This is not a short staffed unit, high-fiving each other and laughing as a young person falls to the ground and ends up with a broken nose and a concussion. I mean, this is not a staffing issue. We have one of the lowest juvenile incarcerated youth populations we've ever had. And so the fact of the matter is that you can't pay folks enough to come into these facilities, and that the staff that we do have are calling out because they don't want to go in. So I think, you know, the fixes that the probation department has made, they're wildly temporary. We're calling people from the field who've spent decades only working with adults who've never even like stepped foot in juvenile facilities. And we're asking them to make these places safe and rehabilitative for young people. I mean, it's really a farce. And so I think my biggest concern really is that young people continue to pay the price for this failed experiment that the county spends $435 million on. That's not chump change.
Let me just ask you about the population of the youths that are incarcerated at Los Padrinos and elsewhere. You mentioned that the population is down considerably, and my understanding is this is in part because you've got the ones who have been convicted of the most serious offenses are sentenced in juvenile court because of the most serious offenses, where in the past maybe it was a wider range of young people who were incarcerated. And so how has that changed in your view how the young people there are considered by staff and just the nature of the threats either to or carried out by the young people, because these are those who have been accused of some of the worst crimes?
I mean, I think that's a really flawed narrative, Larry. And I think we've heard probation officers call into many public meetings talking about how these kids are monsters, how they're youthful, you know, they're offenders who've done the most egregious things, and perhaps they have done egregious things, right? But at the core, they are still children, right? So we can carry on this narrative that they're violent, that they're aggressive, that they're dangerous, and that they deserve to be locked up. But that's not going to solve anything. That hasn't made our streets safer, right?
But that's a separate, hold that thought, because that's kind of a separate issue. Because you've got the meta issue of what's the best public policy? How do we rehabilitate young people? The other issue is, how do you keep the kids safe and the people that work there safe? And so that's kind of where my question is coming from. If you've got younger people that are on average have more of a background of violence that are there, and that's a higher concentration, how do you deal with that? And
go ahead. Sorry. I mean, first of all, I think that when we characterize these young people as dangerous, that's problematic, right? Because when we start talking about them that way, then we treat them like they deserve to be caged and like they're animals, which is currently what's happening. But the fact of the matter remains is that they don't get regular mental health services. They don't get fresh air on a regular basis. They don't consistently get education in a classroom. The young folks who are supposed to be receiving college-level education have college courses maybe once a week for a couple hours, and the rest of the time they're just sitting around. So I think the bigger issue is that we have a bunch of bored kids who have maybe done terrible, horrible things. But at the end of the day, they are bored, and much of their violence, much of their aggression, much of their frustration stems from the fact that they don't have enough staff, they don't have enough people who know how to work with them, right? Like, I mean, there are programs out there like the Credible Messengers who are going in and who are connecting with young people in a very different way and who have very different relationships with these young people. You don't hear about those Credible Messengers talking about the fact that these kids are violent. You hear those Credible Messengers talking about the fact that they've actually built relationships with these young people. You have like teaching artists who go in, who talk about the fact that they actually know these folks. They feel safe with these young folks. They can talk to these young folks. They know how to de-escalate situations, right? But like when we create a situation where young people are constantly being dysregulated and do nothing to stop that, then they're going to act out, and then our instinct is to blame it on whatever they've been, you know, accused of doing. Mind you, all of the young folks in LP, they're pre-adjudication or pre-dispo, meaning they haven't even been convicted of anything. So innocent until proven guilty has got to mean something.
We're talking with Melinda Kakani, who's Youth Justice Director for the Children's Defense Fund California, also a member of the L.A. County Probation Oversight Commission. Jonathan Bird, second VP, Chief Steward for L.A. County Deputy Probation Officers Union. Sir, your response to what Ms. Kakani is saying about the way that the young people in Los Padrinos are being thought of by the people that work there.
Thank you, Larry. And thank Ms. Kakani for her oversight and for her energy that she supplies to making sure that youth in LA County are treated fairly and equitably. Again, I will go back, Larry, and say that a lot of things that are happening currently are the result of neglect from a higher level source, such as the Board of Supervisors and management. The critical staffing is important to succeed in any program. I'll give you a for instance. For instance, 10 years ago, the rank and file had 4,400 workers for LA probation. Today, we have less than 2,400. Now, we have reduced camps and we have reduced certain facilities, but the number of reduction through attrition has not been kept up to by the hiring process because we have had a hiring freeze for probably 8 to 10 years until this current year, where this current board has seen the need to allow the chief to hire the workforce. We will agree that field officers do not specialize in dealing with juveniles. That is a special talent that takes some time, a special training. And therefore, a lot of times when you have in the facility currently, you have those who have come to assist to work with juveniles because of the shortage problems. All of the fundamental programs, the mental health, the being locked in the rooms, this union has advocated with the Board of Supervisors that our infrastructure leads to some of this problems that we have. For instance, Ms. Kakani spoke about someone urinating in a milk carton. Well, if you look at the infrastructure that we have and the buildings that we use to house these youth, they are antiquated. Most of them are over 50 years old, and therefore they don't have the restroom amenities inside of the rooms. We've been advocating for funding. We've even gone to the state to ask for funding to rebuild the infrastructure so that it does not look like a prison, does not look like they're incarcerated. It's more like a place where you would come because you, whatever trouble you got in, they are to provide you services, and the environment and the aesthetics also should look like that so that you have a learning environment. So we will agree on certain things, but in terms of the professionalism of the probation officers, there's no probation officers that are afraid to work in the institution. I think some of the communication has been misguided. When we talk about being unsafe, we're talking about accountability, not necessarily that we are afraid. We are called to do this job. Most of the people in the probation department come right out of the community. I always say sometimes facetiously that the largest community-based organization in Los Angeles County is the probation department, because the community who are dedicated to working with youth, they come from us. They are part of us. And so when we receive these youth, we receive them with the desire to rehabilitate them. I don't say rehabilitate because some of them come from deprived areas, poverty, and that needs to be addressed by the Board of Supervisors and those who clearly want social reforms. But the workers that we represent are professional. They are not afraid. Okay. They're not saying that we are not going to work because it's unsafe. Sometime when we're talking about people not going to work because of the critical shortage, some people are working 16 to 24 hours straight, and the next day they can't show up because they are entirely exhausted. So there's many conversations to be had. What I will say lastly is that we are proud that we finally have a Board of Supervisors that are investing in youth, and any programs, any social reforms, any reimagines that we need can be done through the probation department as a lead, because we deal with community-based organizations. We invite them in. We help them.
I need to break, sir. I'm so sorry, but we'll continue with our guests more on this topic in just a moment on Air Talk. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle with our LAist mental health reporter, Robert Garova, who's been closely following Los Padrinos Juvenile Hall in Downey and the concerns there about the incarcerated youths at that facility, as well as large number of staff call-outs, leaving the facility shorthanded. It also has had, in recent years, a shortage of staff to work at the facility. Robert, I wonder if you can talk just a little bit about to what extent there is a staff shortage and to what extent probation officers have called out.
Well, the Office of Inspector General put out a report. This was last month that looked at an incident from last December, where there was a brief escape at the facility at Los Padrinos, and they looked at staffing issues on that day. And they're supposed to have 100 staff show up. I believe it was 60 called out that day for different reasons. But, you know, when you're supposed to have 100 people show up for work, 60 do not. I think it was 40 called in and said that, you know, I'm not going to be in today. The other 20 just didn't show up. That's a pretty big deal. And a number of people at the state board and elsewhere, activists have pointed to that as a huge issue. I don't have the entire numbers of what they're looking at. Maybe our other guests can fill us in on that, but, that's considerable. And, you know, just as recently as the last couple of weeks, Guillermo Villarosa, the chair, probation chief, has, you know, said that he is continuing to try to pull people out from the field, and they're doing all they can to hire. So it's a continuing issue for the department.
Jonathan Bird of the union, just real briefly, why would probation officers not even bother to call in if they're not coming to work?
Larry, I think that's a systematic problem. We have a new call-out system, and a lot of the officers from the field unit are not familiar with how to access that system in an efficient manner. Most of our people know how to follow the procedures. They do it, and I believe if you speak to the department now, through the proper training, they are responding accordingly. Okay. And most of them are returning back to work.
Red in Sylmar, good to have you with us on Air Talk. Please share your thoughts about this.
Yeah, I wanted to call in for asking and demanding LA County to close Los Padrinos and Barry J. Neidorf, to declare a state of emergency and to free those youth incarcerated.
To just free them, not send them to another facility?
No. So we actually, as like community organizations, I'm also part of Tia Chucha's Central Cultural and Bookstore in Sylmar, and we've actually worked with many and plenty of organizations to create this program called Youth Justice Reimagined, and that will create a lot of family support centers, community culture centers, with the money that they spend on prison, which is actually $800,000 per youth per year. We can use that money to support these centers and support the kids when they come home, so that they have more resources. A lot of the kids that are incarcerated, you know, deal with family issues. Some kids don't have family. They're in the foster care system. So we want to address those and address the root of the problem instead of incarcerating the kids.
Red, let me just ask you, how do you deal with, if you have a youth who is suspected or been found guilty of committing a violent rape, of aggravated assault, of very serious crimes, how do you protect others who might be targeted by that individual if their movement is free and if they're not incarcerated?
Right. Well, kids, like most of the times as kids like commit crimes, they have that influences around them, and they don't make the greatest choices for themselves and for others. So we want to support them and let them know that they don't have to make these choices anymore, that they don't have to like go down this line of where they're committing more harm onto others and not to themselves.
Sure. But changing that mindset and rehabilitation, isn't that a fairly lengthy process? So what do you do in the interim period before they're able to deal with impulse control and all the deficiencies from their childhoods that you're talking about, all the things that have made their lives so traumatic and difficult? What do you do in the interim?
Right. And that's what I'm telling you, man. Like, you got to show these kids love. Like, a lot of the kids, you know, that have gone on the run, that have like joined into gang violence, like they haven't been loved. They don't know what that is. So like, once you show that to them for the very first time, instead of like incarcerating them, like, you know, we were hearing on the Board of Supervisors call, like, public comment from probation that, like, probation officer was getting, like, spit on their face from the youth. And it's like, you're incarcerating children. You're trapping them in a cage. So it's like, you know, what are you going to do if you're getting put into a cage? So it's really important. It's not something that, like, you know, that we've ever even, like, tried before, because we're scared of these kids. And, you know, we call them monsters. We call them, like, dangerous. But, you know, I committed a felony myself, and I had a lot of shame in that. But from there, I realized, like, I can do better. And, you know, I have people that support me and some people that don't, you know, in the community. Some people are still scared of you and whatnot. But, you know, it's important to realize that there's people in your corner that you can look to for resources, for support, for growth, and to learn in better ways.
Red, I appreciate you calling in, and thank you also for talking about the program that you have for youth to help them through this process. We really appreciate it. Let me go back to Robert Garova, who's LA's mental health reporter. Where do we stand overall in juvenile facilities in the county, and are there other facilities that are still found to be deficient?
Well, yes. So there's about 300 kids left at Los Padrinos, although that changes, but about 300. The board was also looking at what's called the Barry J. Neindorf Secure Youth Treatment Facility, which has about 50 young people left in it up in Sylmar. That was also found to be unsuitable, and they were, you know, at risk of having to move kids out of that facility as well. But they, you know, met the minimum requirements, it's my understanding, as well, and they won't have to be moved out of there. There's also a number of camps, you know, there have been issues at camps as well. We haven't brought this up yet. There was a probation employee that was charged with having sex with an inmate, is what they call it. There are a number of other facilities as well. Los Padrinos is the one with the most kids in it at the moment.
We have Misty and Duarte, who we mailed. Guests bring up a great point about not just the number of staff, but the training. I'm a nurse. I work in various psychiatric and special needs environments. All of the facilities are staffed primarily with minimum wage workers with no training on dealing with the population they encounter. It's bizarre to have a few nurses and social workers on hand that go to school for years to learn how we should be operating, just to watch the majority of staff that have the most face time with patients doing the exact opposite, and often escalating conflict. Efforts to implement training are met with a lot of resistance, since for many of the low-paid staff, this is just another job for them, not a career track. Jonathan Bird of the LA County Deputy Probation Officers Union, you want to respond to Misty's email?
I'm sorry, Larry, could you repeat just that last portion?
Yeah, she said, efforts to implement training are met with a lot of resistance, since for many of the low-paid staff, this is just another job for them, not a career track.
I will respond to that again, that we advocate for professionalism in our rank and file. I don't clearly understand the low pay per se. We do believe that we are underpaid for the work that we do. But that's a different topic. The real issue is that the people that work in this probation department in rank and file, we have up to doctorate degrees that are working in these institutions. So they are well educated. They have dedicated their lives to performing services that habilitate youth. So I'm not clear as to how that applies to her email.
And you're not. And the jobs are probation officers paid minimum wage? I didn't think they were paid minimum
wage.
No,
so that's why I'm confused.
Yeah.
We're not minimum wage persons, so I wanted to get clarity on the email. But I would just stipulate that we have a educational requirement for most of our officers that is the highest in this country when it comes to dealing with youth. We dedicate our lives, our training come from our education and also from the training from California standards and also from the directives in our own probation department policies. So we are always interested in learning more. We have MSWs that are in certain institutions that deal with the youth. And so we welcome those, just like we welcome the CBOs. And I think we would do ourselves an advantage if we would work collaboratively rather than trying to be somewhat divisive and ousting one entity from another.
Jonathan Byrd, thank you very much. One of the leaders of the L.A. County Deputy Probation Officers Unions. My thanks to Melinda Kakani, a member of the L.A. County Probation Oversight Commission, Youth Justice Director for the Children's Defense Fund, California. And my thanks to L.A.'s mental health reporter, Robert Garova. You can read his continuing coverage about juvenile facilities in Los Angeles County at LAist.com. Robert, thank you so much. Good to have you with us again. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Coming up, we'll talk with University of Maryland Law Professor Maxwell L. Stearns. His new book, Parliamentary America, The Least Radical Means of Radically Repairing Our Broken Democracy. We'll be back in just 90 seconds.
How to LA is your connection to Los Angeles. Get to know its history.
The 1920s were a huge boom time in Los Angeles, and downtown was just exploding.
Its politics.
It's the biggest local prosecutor's office in the country.
And its food.
Korean spices with like a hint of sweetness.
And just everything we love about LA. Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Just got an email from a listener about our last segment, looking at the Los Padrinos Juvenile Facility in Downey. Damon writes, LA County juvenile halls have been out of compliance for far longer than what they're being held accountable for today. As a Master of Social Work student beginning in 2020, I was advocating for youth addressing these very same issues. Further, LA County probation's been out of compliance with treating youth with basic human dignity for much, much longer, dating back to the days I was incarcerated in these very same juvenile facilities, urinating into empty shampoo bottles on a regular basis back in the 80s. LA County is simply finally being held accountable due to the efforts of Melinda and the Children's Defense Fund and coalitions such as LA Youth Uprising. That's Damon writing to us at LAist.com. We turn our attention now to America's political system. And over the years, we've had some interesting conversations about ways of making major or minor tweaks to our political system. These thought experiments help us better examine our American form of democracy and ways that we think we might improve it. And a new book takes a look at that from the perspective of a parliamentary system, which, of course, those are quite popular in other democracies around the world. Maxwell L. Stearns is a professor of law at the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law. He's written a number of articles and books on the Constitution, the Supreme Court, and the economic analysis of law. His new book is Parliamentary America, The Least Radical Means of Radically Repairing Our Broken Democracy. Maxwell L. Stearns, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Professor, let's start with the difficulty that we have in our system here, sort of breaking through beyond the two-party system. We have a number of third parties, the Green Party, people mount independent candidacies and the like, but it's really a Democratic and Republican, you know, they pretty much have things locked up. And, you know, was that the design of the founders in your view?
Well, it actually historically wasn't the design of the founders to have parties or what they called factions at all. They believed that we were going to have a set of rival games between and among the branches of government, and also with federalism between the national and state and local governments. And instead, really pretty much from the jump, we ended up with a two-party system overtaking those rival games. And you can even go back as early as George Washington's farewell address, where he talks about the fact that partisanship is becoming such an important aspect of our politics. I want to go to something you said at the beginning. You're absolutely right. Although we have a two-party system, it doesn't mean we don't have third, fourth, or fifth parties. It means that those parties play a confounding role, and that when people vote for them, they get punished rather than rewarded. And so the question is, how do we fix our system to actually end the two-party deadlock and have people feel rewarded and be rewarded when they support additional parties.
Before we get to the suggestions that you make here for reform, you know, share with us what parliamentary systems do you think work particularly well in other countries and which have a difficult time?
So one of the things I do in the book is I take the readers on a virtual world tour to seven countries, England, France, Germany, Israel, Taiwan, Brazil, and Venezuela. And every system is flawed in some way, even anti-democratic in some way. But one of the key lessons of the tour is that the real threat to democracy is extremism, having either too few parties, like the US or the UK, you could think of Brexit, or hyper-fragmented parties, too many parties. You could think of Brazil, you could think of Italy, you could think of Israel. And it turns out that the system that was originally designed for Germany after World War II, called mixed member proportionality, really does achieve not having too few or too many parties. It hits the sweet spot that most political scientists think of as between roughly 4 and 8 parties.
4 to 8 parties. And how do those parties establish themselves as reaching a threshold for representation?
So there's two aspects that you have to deal with when you're dealing with a parliamentary democracy. One is what's called a party eligibility threshold, the percentage of seats you have to get to qualify to be seated. That's one factor. But what mixed member proportionality does is it provides two means of representation in the lower legislative chamber. One by district, just like we do now, where you vote for candidates within districts, and that tends to produce two parties that get more seats than any other, because when you have a single person representing a district, the goal politically is to fracture the opposition and keep your side intact. And that's the reason that we end up with a two-party system, because we have politicians who represent us either in congressional districts or by state, or the president who represents the country as a whole. And since both sides perceive the strategy to be to divide the opposition but keep your side intact, we end up with two camps, which is the fundamental problem. Mixed member proportionality adds another means of representation, where you vote by party and you use the party votes to achieve proportionality for the chamber as a whole. And so you end up with more parties than two, but you also end up with that sort of that sweet spot, because the districted elections make it so that you don't end up with hyper-party fractionalization. Two parties are going to get more seats as a result of the districted representation, or what Germany calls constituency seats. But because of the proportionality vote, when you vote by party, neither party will predictably gain a majority. They'll have to form coalitions with other parties to create the government. And that's what you want to do.
And you get some strange bedfellows in those circumstances, don't you?
Well, you can. You can get some strange bedfellows. And I tell some interesting stories about those strange bedfellows. For example, one story involves how we ended up with Brexit in the UK. There's an interesting story about the Green Cons in Ireland. There was a peculiar coalition up until the recent events in Israel. So you can end up reshuffling the deck, but actually that turns out to be a strength. The idea that, I mean, what the framers really feared wasn't so much having parties as having permanently entrenched parties. And the fact that you can end up with some odd combinations, strange bedfellows, means that you have the capacity to reshuffle the deck and not end up with permanent entrenchment of parties that in the information age in the US are just growing increasingly far apart, to the point where, although we once used to think people could read the same source materials as us and in good faith come out the other way, part of the crisis we're experiencing today is that whichever side we're on, we think those on the other side either lack basic intelligence or that they're evil. We're no longer trusting that people can in good faith disagree with us over major issues.
We're talking with University of Maryland law professor Maxwell L. Stearns, author of Parliamentary America, The Least Radical Means of Radically Repairing Our Broken Democracy. If you have questions for him or you'd like to weigh in on this, again, this is the thought experiment we do from time to time, talking about, well, what would alternative forms of an American democracy look like? We're at 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-5722. One of the most recent examples, a few months back, we had a professor from UCLA, Rick Hassan, on to talk about this, about some of his ideas for changes to be made in the way that we elect representatives to Congress and the presidency. 866-893-5722, or you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. You can also comment on our AirTalk page at las.com/airtalk. So back to the German example you gave, post-World War II Germany, mixed member proportionality. So if I heard you correctly, you mentioned there's a lower house that's this by-district voting, which ends up essentially being two parties represented there. So I assume then there's an upper house, and that's, how did the members of that upper house correspond to the votes that are made by party?
No, so that's not quite the way it works. It is both in the lower house. Both, you have basically districted elections for half the seats, but then you have a separate vote by party, and you use the party votes to ensure proportional representation for that entire chamber. And that chamber is empowered to choose. In Germany, it's the chancellor. In the United States, of course, it would be the president and vice president. They also have an upper chamber, but the German upper chamber plays a somewhat less significant role. It doesn't actually choose the head of the government. So imagine that we take our House of Representatives, which has 435 members, and we double it to 870. So you could take a state like Washington State, which has 10 members in its House delegation. Now it has 20. And so the idea is, when you go in to vote every 2 years for the House of Representatives, you cast one ballot in your district. Those district seats are likely to have two parties dominating for the reasons I previously described. But you also cast a vote for a party. And so let's say that you are a progressive Democrat. You're likely to have a choice between the Republican and the Democrat for the district, so you'll likely vote Democrat. But when you vote for party, you'll vote for the progressive party. And that party, the leaders of that party in Congress, assuming they're seated, will say to the leaders of whoever's running the coalition negotiation, I'll join your party. However, the price of my joining the party is that you are going to give something to us. You are going to either give us an appointment in the cabinet, you maybe will give us policy concessions, maybe you'll give us a seat even on the next available seat in the Supreme Court. Suddenly, those who support those third, fourth, fifth parties are no longer punished by voting for a spoiler or what I call a randomizer. Instead, they get something in return for supporting those third parties, because those third parties, when they negotiate to be part of the coalition, mm-hmm. guarantee that they get something of value to their constituents.
And just real quickly, because I have to break, just to clarify. So in the upper house, how do the individuals get chosen to represent the party? If you're voting for a party, if you're voting, I'm green or whatever, and I vote for, how does then the person who represents the Green Party in that upper house get chosen?
Well, it's in the lower house. So the reform here is in the lower house, not the upper house.
Oh, okay.
The lower house has a combination. In Germany, they call it constituent seats and party seats. In the House of Representatives, you would have the district seats and individuals who on a state-by-state basis
both in that
are
house.
Elected by party.
Yeah. Got it. Okay. So the upper house would stay the same. Okay.
The Senate would stay the same. In Germany, the upper house is called the Bundesrat, but it's not affected by MMP. It operates on a different system and somewhat different from our Senate. But in the lower legislative chamber, which has the authority to pick the head of government, you now have two different cohorts of representatives. One group that is represented by district, the other that is elected based on party.
All right.
And then you use the combined party votes to essentially ensure that the entire chamber is elected by proportional representation. The way I do it is simpler than the way Germany does it.
And all that thought, we'll come back to the way you would do it. I need to break. We're talking with University of Maryland law professor Maxwell L. Stearns. His book, Parliamentary America, The Least Radical Means of Radically Repairing Our Broken Democracy, and what the professor was just referring to, he argues that there are three constitutional amendments here that would change the way we vote and end the two-party control of our politics. We'll talk with him about those suggested amendments when we come back in a minute. NPR's Here and Now comes up next on LAist 89.3, the latest on former President Trump's trial that's going on right now, for which the jury is being selected. Right now, we're talking with the author of Parliamentary America, The Least Radical Means of Radically Repairing Our Broken Democracy, University of Maryland law professor Maxwell L. Stearns. Professor, you have three constitutional amendments you propose here. Let's take them briefly one by one. First, doubling the size of the House.
Yes, indeed. So the first doubles the size of the House. Each state's congressional delegation is doubled in size. When you vote, you will cast one vote by district. That's going to result in two parties likely getting more seats than other parties. But you'll also vote by party. And then you take that second set of ballots, the party votes, and use it on a state-by-state basis to ensure proportional representation for each state's delegation to the House of Representatives. And what you end up with is two parties that likely will get more seats than other parties, but an insufficient number of seats to actually have a majority on its own. And if you think about that, what that implies is that in order to successfully campaign, suddenly, as opposed to the present system where we have campaigns of denigration, each side insulting the other, you have to campaign to suggest that you, despite some policy differences, are willing to and enthusiastic about joining with other parties to form a government. That you have enough in common that you can form a government, which is going to make you feel better about voting, and it's going to make the government more responsive. So that's how the First Amendment works.
And the second one, which I just have to say, I can't imagine, as tough as the first one would be, the second one, the way the presidency would be chosen. Please share that with us, because I could never see people abiding that here.
Yeah, so I'm gonna challenge that. I'll say you previously mentioned this is a thought experiment. I just want to say this isn't a thought experiment. This actually is a very serious proposal because unlike every other proposal for constitutional and electoral reform, this is the only proposal that leaves every sitting member of the House and Senate an incumbent in their existing district or state. Most proposals for electoral reform translate into unemployment acts for sitting members of the House and Senate. This uniquely not only lets them keep their seats, but actually gives them additional powers.
How does it? So wait, let me just. And we're so tight on time, unfortunately. But
I know.
How does this give them additional powers? It would seem it dilutes it if you're doubling the size of the House.
Because it allows them to choose the president and vice president through coalition negotiations. And it provides a means of access to power across more parties than two. You no longer have to succumb to the demands of the extreme base of a party, because you'll now, for the first time, have genuine competition over multiple parties, which creates new avenues to power. And even in state legislatures, through party-less systems, you're not going to have to every 2 years run on these campaigns and fundraising strategies. There are going to be other ways to gain access to power than the system that we presently have.
How would you sell your second proposed amendment, though, that Americans would no longer directly elect the president? It's just hard for me to believe Americans would ever accept that.
So think about this. Think about the fact that the United States throughout its history has exported democracy, but never once its system of two-party presidentialism successfully. And yet, if you look across the globe and you look at the most responsive systems, they tend to have two characteristic features: proportional representation and what's called coalition governance, consensus systems of government that are the product of multi-party coalitions chosen within a parliamentary scheme. So you're right, we have to educate American voters so that they understand, they think that they're getting power, but they're forced to choose between the lesser of two evils every 4 years. It's in fact the case that about two-thirds of American voters are dissatisfied with the two-party system and wish for more options. But simply wishing for more options is not going to create more options. We need meaningful reform to create an environment in which third, fourth, and fifth parties can thrive. And the only way for that to occur is through a system in which those parties can play an affirmative role in forming the government. So although people think they're empowered by the final vote, what they're not empowered by is having meaningful influence over what the choices are. And we can end this winner-take-all, two-party presidentialism in favor of a system that allows people to genuinely express their sincere political preferences and not be punished for doing so. This actually gives voters greater power than they have now.
I understand what you're saying. You're making an argument that appeals to logic, and I think just for many of us, when we vote, there's a sense of empowerment that isn't necessarily logical when you look at what an individual vote for a president really means. But there's something about casting your vote next to a name for president that, despite the argument that you're making, I have a very difficult time seeing people giving up that feeling of voting for a person for the presidency. But, Professor, I've loved talking about this. Thank you so much. The third amendment that he proposes, by the way, would allow the House to remove a president with a 60% vote of no confidence based on maladministration of the office. It's a lower standard than the one for impeachment we currently have. Professor Stearns, thank you very much for being with us today. I've enjoyed our conversation.
Well, thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. University of Maryland Law Professor Maxwell L. Stearns, Parliamentary America, the Least Radical Means of Radically Repairing Our Broken Democracy. NPR's Here and Now is next. From all of us at AirTalk, have a terrific rest of your day. I'm back with you tomorrow morning at 9, right after Morning Edition.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of the How to LA podcast. How about we go to the movies? Join us for a 10-part series, Revival House, and discover the magic of LA's indie theaters. Who knows? You might meet someone.
I know it sounds antithetical because you're just sitting passively, but in fact, you're connecting with everyone else around you.
Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.